I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point. 6 months ago today, Russia began its invasion of Ukraine. Today is also Ukrainian Independence Day. The usual parade down Kyiv's main boulevard has been replaced with a column of burned-out Russian tanks, brought in especially for the occasion, a symbol of Ukraine's battlefield successes and to the brutality of this horrible war. President Zelensky's Independence Day speech was given not before a crowd in Central Square, but in a pre-produced video on YouTube.
Вільні народи незалежної України. І цим все сказано. Всього чотири слова, але як багато стоїть за ними сьогодні.
The free people of independent Ukraine, Zelensky declared, then went on to say, quote, that says it all, just four words. But how much is behind them today? On the 182nd day of a full-scale war, how many symbols and meanings, feats and losses, joy and pain are in these words? And mainly, how much truth is in them, our truth, end quote. The truth is that 6 months on, the invasion still touches every part of daily life in Ukraine. It's also true that while Ukrainian forces have kept President Putin's troops from taking more than about 20% of their country, neither side shows any indication that it's prepared to lay down their arms. And so the war goes on. How does Ukraine live with that? Tanya Kozareva is an investigative journalist. She's a 2021 Pulitzer finalist for her in-depth reporting on Ukraine's government corruption. But when the invasion began, Tanya went to the front lines to cover the conflict. She's just moved to the U.S. as a Nieman Journalism Fellow at Harvard University, and she joins us from Boston. Welcome, Tanya.
Very nice talking to you.
So What does this day feel like, this Independence Day, feel like to Ukrainians?
Well, it's hard to tell, but I know for sure that it feels like, you know, like birthday, I would say. And many Ukrainians, I think many more Ukrainians are proud to be Ukrainian these days. It's hard, but at the same time, people, keep going, keep doing what they're doing, keep fighting. Ukrainian soldiers keep fighting, keep protecting the land, the Ukraine, and volunteers are doing the best what they can do. In this situation, people still donating money, although half of the population is unemployed right now. So everyone doing the best what they can do in this situation. Many Ukrainians left the country, as you know, as a refugees. And I think most of them, the main wish they have right now is to be back to Ukraine, you know, to be with their family and with their relatives and friends.
So how has life changed for Ukrainians? Talk more about that. You say that many of them have left. Of course, a lot of people who had other careers, other vocations have now enlisted to fight in this war. Give us an indication of how different life seems for just about everyone in Ukraine, different from a year ago.
Well, life in Ukraine changed dramatically, and you can indicate it in like if you would go to Ukraine 1 year ago, and now it's two completely different states, and the people are different. Some of people left. Definitely, I think this is their right because you know many those who have kids, they are responsible not only for themselves but also for the next generation and for their loved ones. I know a lot of family whose, you know, whose husbands are fighting right now, but they're, you know, they're like mothers and kids, they left the country because, you know, this is something that the best for the whole family, I think.
Go ahead.
So yeah, it's different, you know. The regions that you know, where the active fighting is ongoing, it's a completely different scene. There is a lack of water, gas. You know, like there are no basic, you know, facilities. Like even. Sorry, I'm probably it's maybe inappropriate to talk about this on radio, but it's also, you know, it's impossible to use basically the toilet because the lack of because all the communications are destroyed, so it's a hassle. Some people are using, you know, just plastic bags to go to the toilet, basically to, you know. So it's surviving, you know. It's a surviving situation where people has to, you know, some of them decided to stay because they have no place to go. Some of them, you know, have no relatives, they have no money to go anywhere. So this is the only way to live right now, surviving, you know.
Is there a worry, I mean, that winter is coming, is there a worry that these conditions could get worse?
Yes, this is the biggest concern right now. Local politicians warning about that. They are saying that the winter going to be cold, you know, that people, especially from the eastern part of Ukraine, has to leave these regions because all the communications and like that they are destroyed and broken. And like, yeah, people either has to leave or they has to, you know, they has to sign basically the written letter where they saying, I refuse to move from here. Or I refuse to leave my home. So this is the situation going to be really bad. Not only in eastern Ukraine, it's also, you know, the situation, I think, is relevant to many regions where Russian, you know, where Russian has been, but they're left already. You know, some part of Kyiv region. It's completely, like the north of Kyiv region is completely destroyed and people, you know, they're homeless right now. They're looking for the place to stay. They left the country. So it's not only about East Ukraine. It's also about northern part. It's also about southern part. You know, Kherson region is occupied. But Nikolaev region is close to or next to Kherson, and it's shelled constantly every day, and rockets are landing every day there, and most of the city is like flattened by now, you know. Mm-hmm.
And also in the southern part of the country, the largest nuclear power plant is under Russian control. Is there worry that that could end in disaster?
Yeah, this is the big concern right now. And, you know, we have this history of Chernobylska nuclear plant, which exploded in 1986. We saw, like, you know, we lived through the situation where we saw how nuclear disaster can impact regular population or regular Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. So none of Ukrainians want to live it through again. And, you know, it's a big concern. And also, you know, Russian President Vladimir Putin, sometimes he's threatening to use nuclear weapon. So it's not only about Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant. It's also about neighborhoods, you know, basically.
We heard so much about the resilience of the Ukrainian people, the drive to fight, and also the Western support that Western allies were giving to Ukraine. In Ukraine, is there still a sense among Ukrainians that they have that Western support? Is there fear that this has dropped off the headlines in places like the United States and elsewhere?
It's a big concern because, as I mentioned, volunteers are trying to keep up, but it's a big hustle because, like, most of foreigners or most of the countries, they were very supportive at the beginning of the conflict. But now when, you know, everybody feel like they did something already and it's enough, but it's not enough because, you know, Ukraine is fighting every day, and it's many more people are joining the army. They need clothes, they need boots, you know, they need basic stuff like vests or helmets or ammunition, you know. So it's very you know, I don't want to say interesting situation. It's very challenging right now for Ukrainians, you know, to keep up fighting in the situations where I think Western countries feel comfortable to
Well, Tanya Kozareva, stay with us. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Dorr. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Dorr, and today we're marking a bittersweet Independence Day for Ukraine. Joyful that there's even an Independence Day at all, and yet so intensely anxious about what lies ahead. Tanya Kozareva is with us. She's an investigative journalist from Ukraine. And joining us now is Michael Kaufman, Director of Russia Studies at CNA, a military research and analysis organization based in Washington, D.C. Michael, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me on your program.
So where do things stand militarily in this conflict? What does the battlefield look like today?
Now, it's not easy to describe, but I think right now we're seeing a transitional phase. The battlefield had become somewhat static, particularly in the last month, month and a half. The Russian military has lost much of what momentum they had in the preceding months. And a lot of their advantage, which was particularly due to having much greater amount of artillery and firepower, had been degraded by successful Ukrainian employment of Western systems like HIMARS. So they lost a lot of the initiative. I think the Russian military had been forced to redeploy a great deal of their forces to the southern part of the country in anticipation of a prospective Ukrainian counteroffensive. But that has yet to emerge. And so I think there's somewhat a period of anticipation right now as different folks looking at the war suspect that it's approaching some sort of an inflection point.
Michael, you have said that what happens in the months and years ahead can depend in great part on what Ukraine does in the upcoming weeks. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think Ukraine, or at least Ukrainian military officials, may see the current period as one of a window of opportunity in a sense that with Russian forces, if not exhausted, at least forced to take on a substantial operational pause, the question is then, what will Ukraine do next? And there's a great deal of anticipation that Ukraine may launch a counteroffensive. The exact timing or location is unknown, and I don't think it would help particularly to speculate. But nonetheless, there's been anticipation, both fueled by Ukrainian officials and also by the simple nature of the war and its current trajectory. That is, Ukraine's objective is to take back territory, and it's going to very likely attempt to do so before the winter sets in.
How important is Russia's seizure of the Zaporizhia power plant? Can Russia use that as leverage?
Yeah, it's a very important piece of critical infrastructure. The Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is responsible for a significant percentage of electricity generation in Ukraine. I think what Russia is attempting to do right now is probably to reroute electricity that is power generated by that power plant to the occupied territories and try to leave Ukraine in the cold ahead of the winter. Or they may look to shut down some of the reactors there and then try to blame Ukraine in a sort of provocation.
Tanya, we're talking about morale, and we'll talk more about morale on the Russian side, but what have you seen and heard about the morale of the Ukrainian fighters? Has it slowed at all, or is it still strong, particularly given the troubles that the Russian military is having?
Morale is strong, and every time, you know, I've been to the front line a couple of times and spoke to the fighters, Ukrainian fighters, on, you know, on the positions, and they're all surprised, and, you know, it's surprising to see how brave they are and how how driven they are to protect their land and their families and their, you know, the closest one, the loved ones. So this is, you know, it's very personal for Ukrainians. It's about protecting something that they have and what they love. So I think it's very different for Russians, you know. You cannot compare these things when, you know, somebody is asking you to go and occupy the neighboring country where, you know, we, like, if you will go back in the history or even now, we have a lot of common history with Russia, you know. And some of Ukrainians has relatives in Russia, and, you know, we used to had very close and tight relationship, and overnight, one president decided, you know, to invade Ukraine and to kill, you know, at least 10,000 Ukrainian troops, and God knows how many civilians died already. We know only the statistic of military, but it's hard to count the civil population because, you know, many of them end up in occupied territory where there is no access to, you know.
Yeah. Michael, how important is morale in this equation? I mean, on the Russian side, there are Western estimates that as many as 75,000 troops have been killed or wounded. How is morale? Explain the importance of both the declining morale among Russian troops and the sustaining morale among Ukrainian fighters.
Well, morale is something we often call an intangible because it's very difficult to measure, right? There's a notional perception of it. Ukraine, obviously, is a defending country. The troops there have much higher morale. And the implication of morale is that you have much greater cohesiveness within the forces fighting and a much higher desire to fight despite losses. So if a unit takes high levels of casualties, maybe 30% or even 50%, they're still likely to hold ground and stay in the fight, whereas a force with weak morale might easily give up on an offensive or retreat. But I think a fair assessment of the situation today is that there's been a pretty high level of attrition, high casualties on both sides. Russia has definitely suffered the worst of it. Russian troops had much lower morale to begin with for all sorts of reasons, starting with how the initial operation was run and the pretenses under which they were sent into the war. Today, it increasingly looks to me that the morale amongst Russian forces is low, such that they are half-heartedly, if at all, prosecuting offensives, and only a small part of that force is really trying to prosecute any kind of offensive. But it may not be so low that Russian forces are going to easily fold and cede territory either. So the subject is debatable, but it's a very important one, and I appreciate you raising it.
Tanya and Michael, I'm going to ask you to hold for a moment. We've heard about the Ukrainians willing to fight for their country, but that feeling runs deep in Russia, too, even as the death toll among invading troops rises higher and higher. Olga Ivshina is a correspondent for the BBC's Russian service. She's in London at the moment. Welcome, Olga.
Thank you for having me.
So what is the view of all of this from Russia 6 months into this war?
I guess it depends on which category we are talking about. The moods are very different depending on a number of factors, but the obvious division comes through the age. The younger people are the people you talk to, the less support of the war they show, both in official polls and sort of behind the closed doors. The trouble with the information from Russia at the moment is that it's really hard to measure, it's really hard to understand what's really going on because of all the new laws, because of the whole system, oppressive system built by the authoritarian regime in Russia. It's really hard to understand what people really think because many of them are, well, I would say the majority of them are afraid to express their real views. Maybe some of them are even afraid to think about it. You know, they're even afraid to talk about that in their heads even some of them, you know, especially the younger generation, they grew up like that. If you think about the majority of soldiers currently fighting in Ukraine, you know, many of them were born and have spent their whole life living under Vladimir Putin. They haven't seen another leader. They haven't seen another reality. For many of them, it's really hard to imagine, you know, how things can be different.
Do we know how heavy the Russian losses have been? Has there been any way to quantify that?
There are different assessments of that. As I guess you know, the assessment by U.S. security services is around 15,000-20,000 killed. That's a very conservative assessment. Around 20,000 deaths is an assessment provided by the British security services. Ukrainian officials talk about around 40,000 deaths. We at BBC Russian decided that we would count every single death reported in Russia. So we collect all publicly available information about that. And at the moment, we have confirmed names of 5,800 Russian soldiers killed in action in Ukraine. This is very important because these are deaths which cannot be contested. You know, they have been confirmed by Russian media, Russian officials, by most often by teachers at schools where the soldiers used to study, by sometimes by their relatives. Also, since the number of open source information, the amount of open source information, the amount of statements by the officials is significantly decreasing, we at BBC Russian try to get access and understand what's going on at Russian cemeteries. And so far, we have been managed to get information from 45 cemeteries all over Russia, in cities and tiny villages from the Baltics, from Kaliningrad to the Far East and Siberia to, you know, in Khabarovsk and Vladivostok. And at the majority of those cemeteries, so in 41 out of 45 cemeteries, we have found tombs of those soldiers whose deaths have not been reported publicly. And based on that, we think that our accounts of these, you know, 5,800 deaths, we miss at least half of the Russian soldiers which were buried in Russia. So it seems that at the moment at least 12,000 Russian soldiers were buried in Russia. Of course, it doesn't mean it's not the total size of losses, but it provides you an estimate. So we don't include those who are missing in action. We don't include those who were killed fighting for this private military company called Wagner, and we don't include those who are fighting for so-called armies of self-proclaimed pro-Russian separatist republics in Donetsk and Lugansk. And sort of if you combine all those figures, it comes close, the estimate can come close to 20,000, which is similar to the figures named by American and British intelligence.
I see. Olga, I want to ask you about the story of Pavel Fedlatiev. He's a Russian paratrooper who recently published a diary about his experience on the front lines in Ukraine, and he's scathing about the invasion. Here he is speaking through an interpreter to CNN.
We were dragged into this serious conflict where we're just destroying towns and not actually liberating anyone. All of that's a lie. We are simply destroying peaceful lives. It's awful to realize that Russia is destroying Ukraine and Ukraine hates Russia because of what we are doing, and that the whole world thinks Russians are animals and bad people.
Filatiev also told CNN about the poor conditions and preparations soldiers faced.
Many of us had no food, no water, nor even sleeping bags. Because it was very cold at night and we couldn't sleep, we would find some rubbish, some rags, just to wrap ourselves in to keep warm. Some took laptops, computers, and other technology. Perhaps because their salary does not provide for them to get those in an honest way, many robbed abandoned stores with mobile phones and other things. I don't want to justify their actions, but it is important to understand that their poor level of life pushes them to do such things during war.
So, Olga, with this morale among at least some Russian troops being so low, is it even possible for Vladimir Putin to be able to claim the sort of maximalist victory that he seeks?
Well, first of all, what he says is absolutely coherent. It's absolutely corresponding with what we have seen from the analysis of this almost 6,000 deaths. We see that the majority of soldiers which were killed come from the poorest regions of Russia. They come from the regions where the average salary is lowest in Russia, where there are no other social elites. This doesn't justify their actions, but this just explains, who are these people fighting for the Russian army. But the trouble is that many people, as I said, many people in Russia don't see other options. You know, for many males in that regions, they don't see other opportunities to provide for their families. Also, they have been brainwashed for decades. Certain people grew up under Vladimir Putin. And if you talk about not Moscow, not St. Petersburg, but those remote towns and villages, they don't have, only in the past like 5 years they happen to have the good connection there, stable internet. Before that, their main source of information was state TV, and Russian state TV is famous for its propaganda machine, which is very evil, but it works, unfortunately, in a very talented and very persuasive manner. And as we see now, for example, since Russian army did experience significant losses, especially not only the numbers matter, but also the quality of, so to say, of those killed. We know that Russia has lost at least 60 of its highly trained military pilots. We know that Russia has lost hundreds of its most trained special forces, sort of Russian equivalent to SIS or Navy SEALs. That's why they need way more people, and we see that they're recruiting those people, the old veterans, people over 40, over 45 years old. They are currently recruiting at the prisons, and what we hear from the prisons, for example, that people there, their access to information is even more limited than in ordinary Russian cities and towns. So they absolutely believe that they're going to Ukraine to fight Nazis, and they are highly motivated to start a new life, so to say, and also to express some anger and earn or loot some money. Because of all that, just because of how this repressive machine works, I think Mr. Putin, unfortunately, can keep getting more and more people involved with the Russian army to fight.
Olga Ivshina is a journalist with BBC Russia. Thank you so much for joining us. Tanya Kozareva and Michael Kaufman, stay with us. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, we're marking 6 months since Russia invaded Ukraine. I'm joined by Tanya Kozareva, a Ukrainian journalist and now a Nieman Journalism Fellow at Harvard University, and Michael Kaufman, Director of Russia Studies at the CNA think tank in Washington. Tanya, when President Zelensky gave his independent speech today, he said, among other things, "We will put up our hands only once when we celebrate our victory, the whole of Ukraine, because we do not trade our lands or our people. For us, Ukraine is all of Ukraine, all 25 regions without any concessions or compromises." Tanya, he includes in that Crimea. So what exactly would Ukrainians be willing to give up, if anything, to see peace at this stage?
It's a very complicated question. I think most of Ukrainians will tell you that they want every square and every kilometer of their territory back. And people, relatives who are on occupied territory, they want to return them, they want to have the access to them, they want to travel to these regions, they want to be able to visit their relatives, and this is something that they cannot do right now. So yeah, for many Ukrainians, I think this is very complicated questions and I don't think this is something that, that can be decided right now. I'm not sure that Ukrainians are willing to give up Crimea or occupied territory to make a peace deal. I'm not sure about that. And I think for President Zelensky, this is one of his, motive to continue fighting and to continue protecting his land, our land, just because he feels this amount of enormous support from the population of Ukraine.
And Michael, is Ukraine on the same page as its Western allies when it comes to the end game of this conflict? Do they expect the same things in terms of what the end game looks like?
Well, it depends who you ask. Western allies is a diverse group of countries, from the United States to Estonia. There are probably different views among them. I think to try to answer the question fairly in general, I suspect so. But the stated political goals of Ukraine are to retake lost or occupied territory, and perhaps the interim goal is to take it back at least to the February 23rd lines. But it's very clear that there's not going to be any sort of return to a status quo antebellum, that there's not going to be a return to those lines, because realistically, if Ukraine has the ability to inflict this kind of defeat on the Russian military and take back territory that far, then they can also retake much or most of the Donbass as well, that is the territory that was occupied in 2014 and 2015. As far as the long term and the end game, it's very difficult to see right now. I think that's a question probably much better asked later this year as we get into the winter. In my view, at this stage, there is no sort of natural stalemate on the ground. And in fact, more than likely, there's going to be yet another chapter to play out in this war before the year is over.
What do you mean by another chapter to play out?
Well, it's very likely going to be a Ukrainian counteroffensive. I think we just discussed this earlier. And depending on how that will go, it will shape expectations both in Ukraine and amongst Western supporters of Ukraine. That is, it'll certainly affect assumptions as to the extent that Ukraine can retake territory, what the long term of the war looks like, and what the best strategy is for supporting Ukraine moving forward.
Yeah. Tanya, what do you think when you think of what is needed to support Ukraine at this point? What is needed the most there?
Oh, it's a long list. I think the priorities for now, I think weapon for sure. Then it's a humanitarian crisis. So, it's a long list of things that's needed right now in Ukraine, from medicine to clothes, very basic things. I think, if your listeners are hearing this, I think this is the good day, Independence Day, to donate to the charities that you know who support in Ukraine these days, and the charities that you trust. Many refugees right now, I think in US too, they needed support, you can help Ukraine in many ways.
Michael, we've talked about the Russian troops losing morale and perhaps reaching at least temporarily an exhaustion point, but that juxtaposed to Vladimir Putin's view that reclaiming or claiming Ukraine is a part of his destiny, that he is the most staunch believer of his own ideology. And these things, at least for now, are in conflict. Do you see that affecting how this war continues, or do you think there will be an ability of the Russian military to recover?
Well, I think right now the Russian military is doing about what it can do. It's not performing particularly well at all. In fact, I think many of these issues are going to worsen in the coming months, and it's going to be quite a period of vulnerability for the Russian armed forces. That said, the political perceptions from my point of view in Moscow are quite different. I think Russian leadership still thinks that they are winning this war and are not acting as though the military means they have available are in no way commensurate to the maximalist political goals that they're trying to pursue. But at some point, I think there might be an epiphany in the Kremlin as it becomes obvious that Russian forces are going to struggle to even take the Donbass, let alone those regions of Ukraine that Vladimir Putin wants to occupy. That said, I don't think that there's any kind of political settlement on the horizon or ceasefire agreement or anything like that in the offing. I think the objectives are irreconcilable. I think both sides, particularly Ukraine, but also Russia in this conflict, believe that they can still win. And I also think that Russia's long-term goals, if they had the opportunity to attain a prolonged operational pause, fix some of their manpower issues, fix some of their issues in terms of morale and support for the force, would be to prosecute a second campaign and try to capture Ukraine's southern coast, that is, go all the way to Odessa, in an effort to destroy the economic viability of the country. That's just my interpretation, is that Vladimir Putin is not going to be satisfied until he feels that Russian forces have essentially destroyed Ukraine's viability as a state. And I don't think that's remotely reachable in terms of what the Russian military can do. I just think that that remains the Kremlin's long-term objective.
And if that continues, if that does happen, on a previous show at the three-month point, we talked about Western allies not all being on the same page about what victory looks like. Some thought it would involve some compromise. Others, and certainly President Zelensky, says no, complete victory. Might we see more disagreement among the Western allies, and what might that mean for Ukraine?
Well, I'm not sure to what extent we're going to see disagreement. It depends on how the coming months unfold. I think one of the challenges you're going to see in terms of sustained Western support is that many European countries have already given much of the military equipment they have available. These are not large, extensively supplied militaries to begin with, and they've likely given most of what they had or what they could spare. Whereas the United States, of course, has a tremendous amount of equipment, robust defense, industrial sector, and what have you. But it, too, will be strained over time and will have to try to put support, I think, for Ukraine on a sustainable footing. I think many folks might be surprised to find out that in the United States, we don't necessarily produce that much ammunition for artillery or maybe that many rockets. And these are all challenges that any country faces in a prolonged conventional war, because these conflicts often come down to attrition and your ability to replace ammunition and equipment and what have you. I'm just sort of highlighting the broader challenges that I think could be faced in this conflict if you look out more to the long term.
And Tanya, Ukrainian democracy has always been fractious. Are there internal tensions in the Ukrainian government that could spill out and make this war more difficult to fight?
Right now, it doesn't seem this way. I think right now Ukraine is very united and supportive regarding the current government and President Zelensky specifically. There are a lot of criticism regarding some of his closest allies, like chief of his office, Andriy Yermak. Many journalists and anti-corruption organization, NGOs, criticizing him and, have a lot of stories to tell about him. But regarding President Zelensky himself and basically his office and his government, I think Ukrainians are very supportive, and they're, I don't see that anyone right now in political, any other politicians who are declaring his will to go to be a Ukrainian president, which is right now very, complicated position to be in. And I don't think anyone challenging President Zelensky right now internally. It's clearly something that is very surprising because, he has all the power in the country right now, and I think it's a big question for him, how will he use this support in the future? Right now it looks like he is very much supported by the whole population of Ukraine.
And Tanya, talk a little bit more about what the symbolism of this day, this Independence Day, is. We talked earlier about the fact that there are burned out Russian tanks in the streets. There have also been expressions of support from world leaders. Outgoing British Prime Minister Boris Johnson went to Kyiv to offer his support to Zelensky and to support him in saying that there should be no concessions. President Biden from the U.S. has pledged another nearly $3 billion in weapons and other equipment aid. What does that mean on that symbolism mean on this day for Ukraine?
Oh, I can tell you that all Ukrainians are following international support, and Prime Minister Boris Johnson is like very loved by Ukrainians. I know that he is criticized in UK, but Ukrainians adore him because his support mainly, and this and his dedication to support Ukraine, and the same about President Biden. So it's right now it's a lot of if you will open like Ukrainian newsfeed, Ukrainian social media, or if you're following Ukrainians in social media, you'll see a lot of people who are wearing national clothes. You'll see a lot of people who are posting about how amazing is Boris Johnson and Joe Biden sending this all enormous support to Ukraine. So it's something that helps to keep up fighting, I think, for many Ukrainians and for many Ukrainian soldiers too.
And Michael, you said one of the biggest challenges Russia faces is the way they have waged this war, trying to, as you said, fight this war without declaring a war. What do you mean by that? And will that be a continuing challenge?
It will be, because the Russian military has tried to find a lot of piecemeal solutions in an effort to muddle through and continue to feed additional manpower into this war. But the truth is that they have major retention issues. They are forced to hire up a lot of volunteers at varying ages for short-term contracts, and those individuals are likely to quit once they've made their money and those contracts are up. And the Russian military is almost entirely deployed in this war. There aren't additional forces for Russia to be able to pull its units off the line and give them rest. They can't rotate forces. The additional units they're sending in, they are using up what officers and enlisted professionals are left in the force to lead those units, and they're going to need those people to basically train and maintain the military. So in effect, they are cannibalizing the military over time in order to sustain this current war in Ukraine. And so I don't want to paint the picture that the Russian military is somehow nearing some imminent collapse, but the story I'm trying to tell is that the way they're attempting to fight this war without enacting a set of policies to sustain it, it's not going to last forever. They have major issues because of that.
And Michael Kaufman is director of Russia Studies at the CNA think tank in Washington. Thank you for joining us. And Tanya Kozareva is a Ukrainian investigative journalist. Thank you for joining us, Tanya.
My pleasure.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.